Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're getting into something really core to how we operate, you know, our sense of self-worth.
Mm-hmm.
And we're tackling this head-on in Chapter 4 of Unraveling the Fabric of Fear, which is Self-Worth, the Quest for Respect.
Such a good chapter.
Everyone wants respect, right? This book kind of frames things in a, well, a unique way, right? Talking about human behavior through the lens of energy.
Emotional energy, specifically.
Yeah.
And how it all falls somewhere on this spectrum from love to fear.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting.
And if you've been with us, you'll know we've already looked at things like being in the now, the whole blame cycle, dealing with ego.
Exactly. And those ideas, they definitely feed into what we're talking about today. We might touch back on them a bit. So how does self-worth fit into that whole love-fear spectrum? Like, what is it, really? And how do we know if we're, you know, measuring up? It's a feeling.
Yeah, it's a feeling of, like, worthiness, belonging. Like, you matter in the world. And you get that from, well, from how you interact with other people.
Yeah, and the chapter kicks off with some helpful definitions. It talks about self-worth. That's the value we put on ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Internal.
Yeah.
And then social value, which is how others seem to value us.
And here's the twist the chapter really focuses on. Our self-worth isn't like a direct reflection of what others actually like. It's tied to what we think they'll find pleasing or valuable.
Ah, okay. So it's about our perception of what others value. We're sort of guessing.
We're constantly guessing, yeah. And then we try to be that thing we think others will be drawn to.
Trying to match that guess.
Right. We're chasing after what we think other people value, even if it's not what they actually care about, you know?
It's like we're trying to fit into a box that doesn't even exist.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. It's like we're all caught up in this massive social comparison game, trying to score points in a system that, well, honestly, a lot of the time, it's just totally arbitrary.
So instead of focusing on what actually makes us valuable, you know, like our skills, our talents, all that good stuff, we're chasing after, what, some kind of approval rating?
The idea is if we can get that social value, that approval from others, our own internal self-worth gets a boost. It's like this engine driving our behavior.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to feel better about ourselves by gaining what we see as social currency.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not even a real rating system. It's all in our heads.
This is often subconscious, right? This whole system we use to value each other.
Very much so. We're not usually sitting there making like a logical checklist about someone's social value. It happens fast, often beneath conscious thought.
And the same goes for anticipating our value in the eyes of others.
Yep. Also largely subconscious. It can bypass our critical thinking.
Like we're all players in a game we don't even realize we're playing.
I think that's a good analogy.
And there's that interesting side note in the text. Even if someone totally disconnects, lives alone.
Oh, right. The hermit example, sort of.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. They still find value in something. Maybe it's nature, maybe animals, maybe just their own code. And they still look for patterns, try to fit in or gain acceptance within that context, whatever it is.
So it's inescapable, this drive. It just shifts its focus.
Pretty much.
The chapter brings up social identity theory here.
Right. How we see ourselves based on our groups.
Exactly. And our status in those groups. Think about that that line study they mentioned.
The visual one with the lengths of lines.
Yeah, that one. Over 75% of people went along with the obviously wrong answer just because the group did.
Wow. That's a powerful pull.
It really shows how strong that subconscious drive to fit in, to gain that social approval can be. We learn conformity pays off, socially speaking.
Conforming works. To an extent. We learned that early. Think about schools, right?
Oh, yeah. The right clothes, the right music. Like political leaders.
Okay, yeah.
They might be amazing at winning popularity contests, but they might actually lack, you know, real leadership qualities.
Are they really leaders, or are they just incredibly good at reflecting what they think people want to see? Followers, in a way.
It's a provocative question, isn't it? If you get power by being popular, by reflecting perceived desires, are you leading with your own vision or just mirroring?
Exactly.
It raises questions about authenticity, doesn't it? If you're always a mirror, where are you?
Food for thought. So we learn to conform first. And then the chapter suggests we might move towards seeking like an alpha role, trying to be seen as superior somehow.
That's the progression it outlines. First fit in, then maybe try to stand out on top.
Oh, like it's baked into being human, this need for social value. So we're all kind of stuck in this competition, even if we don't want to be.
Yeah, it's a pretty common human experience.
So how does this game work? How do we earn points, so to speak?
Well, we earn points in all sorts of ways, sometimes without even knowing it. It can be by conforming, trying to fit in with the crowd, right? Or through our accomplishments, you know, trying to stand out and be the best.
Right.
And then, unfortunately, sometimes it's by putting other people down to try to make ourselves look better.
Feeling threatened when someone else seems superior.
Right. The chapter talks about how when we see traits in others we think are better than ours, we often anticipate, subconsciously again, that our own social value will drop.
Like it's a limited resource. If they gain, I lose.
Yeah, like a zero-sum game.
And the text is clear. This can cause real psychological harm. It mentions that study on monkeys, where lower rank in the group correlated with lower dopamine levels. That feeling of being devalued hits hard, biologically even.
Exactly. And remember those early chapters about how fear operates like beneath the surface, shaping so much of our behavior?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a kind of a wake-up call, honestly.
Think about, I don't know, classic high school stuff where the popular group tries to stay on top by putting other people down or excluding them. And it just reinforces that fear-based mindset we were talking about, leading to behaviors that ultimately hurt everybody. Our deep-seated fear of inadequacy, the fear of not being good enough, is often what drives us into these unhealthy patterns of competition and comparison.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's like we're so afraid of being seen as less than.
And that warning box, that's pretty chilling, too.
It really is. That tactic of isolating someone, making yourself their only source of worth by tearing down their other connections.
Super manipulative. Creates this awful dependency.
Yeah, really toxic stuff. So we're drawn to people who might boost our value, and we avoid those who threaten it. That instinct makes sense now.
Yeah, associating with someone famous to sort of bask in their reflected glory. The chapter calls it scavenging social value.
Scavenging, huh? Not exactly a long-term strategy.
No, probably not sustainable for genuine self-worth.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it? Where do you, listening right now, where do you look for that validation? What do you think earns you respect in those circles?
And this leads to a really key takeaway in the chapter.
Which is?
That the people who earn the most real, lasting social value aren't the dominators or the scavengers. They're the ones who actually help other people generate their own value.
Hold on a second. Are we talking like straight up cooperation here? Because that goes against everything we're told about, you know, getting ahead in the world.
It does, doesn't it? We're bombarded with messages about winning, being the best, all that. But this chapter makes a really compelling case for cooperation being the key to personal fulfillment and societal progress.
But what about, like, healthy competition? I mean, don't we need that drive to push ourselves and, you know, achieve great things?
That's a great question. And it's justified using examples from nature, the survival of the fittest kind of logic, even though that's often a misapplication. The chapter pushes back on that competition is healthy mantra.
How so?
It suggests that while, yeah, competition might be part of how we figure things out, how we develop skills, cooperation is actually a more advanced, more beneficial stage of interaction.
More advanced. I like that.
And it mentions Pauline V. Rosenau questioning this whole fetishization of competition, even framing it potentially as a public health issue because of the stress and inequality it can drive.
A public health issue. That's a strong statement. It certainly permeates entertainment, sports, this in-group, out-group thinking.
Absolutely. It's everywhere. Chapter 4 argues that while competition might be part of the journey of understanding social value, it's not the destination.
So wait, are we essentially talking about like a fear-based approach to self-worth versus a love-based approach?
I think that's a really powerful way to put it.
But honestly, I think a lot of people, myself included sometimes, struggle with letting go of that competitive mindset. Maybe it's not about giving up on striving for excellence altogether, but about making sure that fear and insecurity aren't the ones driving the bus, you know?
Exactly. It's about finding that sweet spot where you can still push yourself to grow and evolve, but without needing to prove yourself all the time.
Finding that inner peace, that confidence, that would be amazing.
It is amazing. And you know what? When you operate from that place of inner peace and confidence, it changes how you interact with others, too.
Oh, how so?
It's like you're not trying to tear them down to build yourself up anymore. You're coming from a place of mutual respect and appreciation. You want everyone to succeed.
That sounds like a much healthier and more sustainable way to live, honestly. Instead of trying to beat others, it's about trying to be our best selves.
Ooh, got it. And the cool thing is, this shift in behavior, it doesn't just benefit others. It actually has a really powerful impact on your own sense of self-worth.
Or I see what you mean, because then your self-worth isn't based on external validation or comparing yourself to other people. It comes from knowing that you're like making a positive impact.
Yeah, you got it. It's a much deeper and more sustainable source of self-worth.
Okay, I like that. It's about contribution, not domination. It mentions the Harvard study acknowledging some data concerns, but agreeing on the principle and work by Dr. Julia Lee and Carol Dweck. The gist is positive reinforcement works way better than constant criticism.
The 5-to-1 ratio thing. 5 positives for every negative.
Something like that, yeah. In thinking about the emotional spectrum from the book, wouldn't that kind of leadership fall more on the love side?
Absolutely. Because it's about wanting to help others grow, right? Mm. Rather than coming from that fear of not being in control. But then you look at something like advertising.
Which often does the opposite.
Right. The chapter points out how ads frequently try to manipulate what we perceive as sources of social value. They create a sense of lack, inadequacy, if you don't have the right product, the right look.
Making you feel less than, so you'll buy something to feel more than.
Pretty much. And linking back to the subconscious stuff we talked about, advertising is incredibly effective at tapping into that.
Even if we think we're ignoring it.
Yeah. The research cited, like the Custer's and Art study, talks about how repetition and linking products to positive cues can build this sort of unconscious will that shapes our desires without us even realizing it.
Like the soda commercial example in the source, it creates an association, even if you weren't paying close attention.
Exactly. And it brings up that Robert Sapolsky quote.
The one about feeling poor.
Yeah. It isn't about being poor, it is about feeling poor. Advertising is brilliant at making people feel like they're lacking, driving that cycle of seeking external fixes for an internal feeling.
Man, that's quite a system influencing us.
That's where the book gets really practical. It provides some specific tools for, you know, navigating that whole journey.
Okay, I'm all ears. What kind of tools are we talking about?
Well, the chapter talks about this idea of cultivating a mindset of abundance.
Abundance.
Yeah. Instead of scarcity, like there's enough for everyone. My worth doesn't depend on me having more than you, you know? When you believe that, it can help you let go of that fear-driven need to compete.
I like that. Abundance over scarcity. But how do we actually do that? Especially when, I mean, let's be real, there is a lot of scarcity and inequality in the world.
It's true. It's not always easy. But I think it starts with shifting your focus instead of always looking at what you lack, what you don't have, what you're not. Appreciate your strengths, your talents, your unique gifts. Celebrate those instead of constantly comparing yourself to others. Taking the time to just like appreciate all the good things in your life, both big and small, it really helps you shift from that feeling of lack to a feeling of abundance. Like, I have enough. I am enough.
So instead of looking outward for validation, we need to like turn inward, cultivate that self-acceptance and appreciation.
You got it. And, you know, things like mindfulness and gratitude practices can really help with this. The book also talks about forgiving yourself.
It's like a vicious cycle. The more we criticize ourselves, the more we need validation from other people, and the less we trust our own worth.
Exactly. So self-forgiveness, it's crucial for breaking free from that cycle. It's about acknowledging that you're not perfect, accepting that you're a work in progress, and extending the same compassion to yourself that you would offer to, I don't know, a close friend or a loved one. When you start practicing self-forgiveness, you naturally become more compassionate and understanding towards other people. It ripples outward, you know, it creates more harmonious relationships.
So forgiveness, both towards others and towards ourselves, is a powerful tool for building that love-based approach to social value, and it helps us strengthen our own self-worth in the process.
Chapter 4 also talks about the importance of humility.
Now, that one can be tricky. A lot of times, humility is seen as putting yourself down or like downplaying your accomplishments.
It's not about self-deprecation at all. True humility is about recognizing that we're all connected and that a lot of times our individual achievements, they wouldn't have been possible without the support and collaboration of other people. When you approach life with that mindset, you're less likely to get caught up in those ego-driven pursuits or comparing yourself to everyone else.
It's more about we're all in this together.
Exactly. And that shift has a huge impact on your relationships too. When you're not constantly trying to like prove yourself or one up everyone else, you create space for genuine connection and collaboration.
That sounds like a much more enjoyable and fulfilling way to live, to be honest.
Humility is about approaching life with a sense of gratitude and openness, knowing that we all have something to learn from each other.
Any other tools in this toolkit?
Chapter 4 also highlights the importance of curiosity.
Curiosity keeps us humble, it keeps us learning, it keeps us growing.
And that continuous growth That's key for developing a healthy sense of self-worth. When you're constantly learning and evolving, you're less likely to get stuck in those rigid self-perceptions or need validation from other people, you know? Your self-worth becomes more rooted in your own unique journey of growth and discovery.
So it's like you're building your self-worth from the inside out instead of relying on external validation to hold you up.
Precisely. Okay, so as the chapter wraps up its main points, it brings in religion and spirituality.
Yeah, it briefly looks at how different traditions handle this whole quest for respect and self-worth. It provides a broader context.
Interesting. So, like the Christian perspective, it mentions inherent worth, right? Like from 1 John being loved and chosen by God, separate from social status.
Mm-hmm. And the whole love your neighbor as yourself idea from Matthew, which is fundamental to mutual respect.
And Islam. The Quran quote about the most noble being the most righteous.
Yeah.
Again, focusing on inner character, not social rank.
Right. And the hadith mentioned connects good character to being loved by both Allah and people, linking the spiritual and the social.
Then there's Buddhism, focusing on self-development first, like in the Dhammapada, self-worth from inner work.
Yeah. And that concept of the self as awareness, not just the body or ego, shifts the focus inward again.
And Hinduism, the Bhagavad Gita, talking about equanimity, being free from attachment and fear.
Yeah.
Qualities of inner strength, defining worth.
Exactly. Internal source again.
And it also mentions thinkers like Eckhart Tolle about getting beyond the ego.
Right. Suggesting that worth based purely on external stuff is kind of illusory. So how does this all connect back to the start, the self-worth and social value definitions?
Well, if self-worth is the value we place on ourselves and social value is what others place on us or what we think they do, these religious perspectives offer pathways to build robust self-worth that isn't solely propped up by the shifting sands of social value.
They offer alternative anchors.
Anchors, yeah, that's a good word. Anchors in inner principles or divine connection or self-awareness or detachment things less vulnerable to external opinion or competition.
That's a really crucial contrast the chapter draws.
Absolutely. That quest for respect, for social value is powerful. Mm-hmm. But the big insight, I think, from digging into this chapter is that genuine, lasting self-worth. It doesn't come from dominating or stealing value.
It comes from contribution.
Yeah, from contributing to the value of others, lifting them up. That seems to be the more sustainable and, frankly, more fulfilling path.
When we see people actually living these principles in their own lives, mm-hmm. it inspires us to do the same. It shows us that this more love-based approach to social value, it's not just some pie-in-the-sky idea. It's actually possible.
For sure. And we all have the potential to be those role models for others, whether it's in our families, our workplaces, our communities, even online. It's about making a conscious choice to embody those principles of love, humility, and curiosity in everything we do. And remember, this deep dive into chapter 4, it's really just the beginning. There's so much more to explore. In the next chapters, we're going to see how this whole quest for respect ties into things like jealousy.
Oh, interesting.
And the search for what the book calls unconditional compassion, which is, well, it's described as like the highest state of mind.
Okay, now that's something I definitely want to hear more about.
You know, the coolest thing about this book, it's a live project on Google Docs. So anyone can contribute.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
You can share your insights, join the conversation. It's amazing.
It's like this book is constantly growing and changing with input from people all over the world. It's a perfect example of what we've been talking about, right?
Yeah.
Collaboration, shared learning, all that good stuff. So if you're feeling inspired or if you just want to learn more, definitely head over to Google Docs and add your voice to the mix.
And remember, true self-worth, it doesn't come from, you know, climbing some social ladder or getting to the top of the heap. It comes from recognizing the inherent value in everyone, including yourself. And that's a really powerful message to carry with you as you move through the world.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, everyone. We'll be back soon with more insights and aha moments from unraveling the fabric of fear. Until next time, stay cool, stay kind to yourself, dive deep.